I've called my book This Being, That Becomes. And this is because this is how the Buddha described his teaching of conditionality. The word conditionality is a word I'm using as an easy way, a memorable English way, to try and get across a teaching of the Buddha called Paticca-samuppada, or in Sanskrit, Pratitya-samuttapada. You might have come across this term, and it means dependent arising, or some people translate it conditioned co-production. Either way, it doesn't immediately tell you what it means. It's as much a technical term in Sanskrit or Pali as it is in English. And in my opinion, at least, the word conditionality, it at least gets across the idea. Oh, conditions. But it's important in the Buddha's teaching. That's why we're talking about it tonight. In fact, it's so important, you could say it's the very essence of the Buddha's teaching. In a sense, I wouldn't want to say it's the only essence of the Buddha's teaching, as it were. But if you wanted to know what was the philosophical core, what was the most important idea of the Buddha, then we could definitely say it's Paticca-samuppada, dependent arising, or conditionality. So my job tonight is to try to get across why that might be and what the Buddha meant. And it's quite difficult, because what the Buddha meant was not exactly easy to understand. And yet, on the other hand, it is accessible. So I'll have a go. I've titled my book This Being, That Becomes, and that's a translation of a phrase in the Pali language which the Buddha offered as a general principle, the most broad sort of principle of conditionality, which runs Imasming Sati, Idang Hoti, Imasu Pada, Idang Upajati, Imasming Asati, Idang Nahoti, Imasa Nirodha, Idang Nirujati, which means this being, that becomes, from the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. From the ceasing of this, that ceases. So it's a symmetrical, memorable kind of form of words that goes back to the Buddha, as far as we know. These things are far from certain. And tries to sum up the what Paticca-samuppada or conditionality is about. So I think we can put that fairly straightforwardly into English terms. Everything arises on particular causes and conditions. And when those causes and conditions cease, those things cease to be. You can probably find your own way, your own form of words to express that thought, as it were. There's nothing, as it were, completely special about the Buddha's formulation of it, although actually in the Pali language it's very particular. It uses particular forms of words to get across particular kinds of causal forms of explanation, but that's the kind of thing I like to research, as it were, but it's I'm not going to go into that tonight. The difficulty comes in seeing how this general principle works in our ordinary lives, in our experience, how it's supposed to be applied. There's a well-known story in the Pali Canon, which is the record of the Buddha's teachings in the Pali language, where Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant, says something like, Paticca-samuppada. He's talking to the Buddha. Lord, this is a difficult doctrine, but to me it seems as clear as anything. To which the Buddha replied, say not so, Ananda, say not so. Dependent arising, which is to say, paticca-samuppada, is profound, and it seems profound. It's through not understanding this teaching that people are trapped in samsara, the wheel of re-becoming, the endless wheel of suffering. It's through not understanding paticca-samuppada. And this reminds us that although the idea sounds fairly straightforward, and you might think, oh yeah, I get that idea. In practice, the way the Buddha used it is not so easy to understand. And this is worth bearing in mind, as it were. It's not so easy to understand. And the Buddhist doctrines that are based on it get increasingly difficult. So I won't go into too many of them this evening. I'm just going to concentrate on the broad principle. I've been thinking about this since the book was published. What do we mean by a general principle in the Buddhist teaching? It clearly is supposed to apply to everything. Paticca-samuppada is supposed to be true of everything. Everything except nirvana, actually, which is the unconditioned. But it's not as though the Buddha is teaching a metaphysical account or theory which you're supposed to believe. It's more like paticca-samuppada, or conditionality, is something that you might discover. It's a way of seeing things. That's the way I'm starting to think about it. It's a philosophical theory. In the old sense of theory, the old Greek sense of theoria, a way of seeing. A way of seeing which, if you employ it, if you get used to it, reveals the world in a new way. So if you're able to see how things arise on conditions and cease when those conditions cease, if you could see that in your everyday life, especially within your own experience, then you would be seeing things as a Buddha sees them. That's what this teaching means. This is quite important, actually. The reason why it's the paticca-samuppada is the essence of the Dharma, the core teaching, is because, in a sense, it represents how an awakened mind thinks, how the Buddha experiences things, which broadly you could say is as it experiencing as arising on conditions and ceasing when those conditions cease. It's often said that, as it were, the content of the Buddha's thinking on the night of his enlightenment was his reflection on paticca-samuppada, was his discovery of paticca-samuppada. I say it's often said because, of course, we weren't there. Nobody was there except the Buddha on the night of his awakening. And there's several different ways in which it's written about in the Pali Canon. So possibly now you might have some idea why I was introducing these reflections in meditation. I don't know what you made of them. I've been thinking about how it might be possible to try and bridge, right from the beginning, rather abstract ideas with quite straightforward experience in presenting conditionality. So in meditation, I was suggesting you just look at the quality of the breath to see how it's changing. Which is to say, how it's not a a repeating thing that continues in a sort of unchanging way. There's a continually changing pattern and quality to the breath. Did anybody notice anything interesting from those, or unexpected from those reflections that I dropped in? Or was it, did it not work?
It worked for me, although it wasn't unexpected necessarily. Yeah. I noticed every breath was different, and I was quite pleased with that.
Pleased that you noticed that the breath, the each breath was different.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And then I got you to, I invited you to broaden your awareness to what you might have felt or heard. Did anyone notice anything of interest there?
I was noticing my back pains.
You were? Yes. Did they stay the same?
No, actually, they continued to shift as well. Yeah. I mean, to the sensation. I mean, it was stronger.
Yeah.
Just,
yeah, yeah.
It came and went.
Yeah, yeah. That's the kind of thing I was imagining people might notice, that certain sensations, especially pain, I suppose, although they seem constant, actually vary within limits. So sameness is a kind of change, really. So all the time, in fact, our experience consists in changing phenomena of sensation, of thought, of breathing, and so on.
In comparing your breath,
yes.
It's as if you're rather than staying in the moment, you're having to hold on to the past in order to compare.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Knowing that you're going to need to make a note and compare it with the present breath.
Right.
Yeah. That was a dilemma for me.
Yes. Well, I was getting you to do something a bit more, something that was more to do with thinking rather than simple awareness. Is that right?
Yeah.
So it slightly took you out of the meditation. And out of the moment, yeah. And in a way, this is like a dilemma in presenting ideas on conditionality, is that we have to abstract from the present moment to get the bigger picture, as it were. But I think that's what, in some ways, that's what we need to do to understand the big picture of our experience.
It strikes me.
Yeah.
Within mindfulness, there are these two elements of sati, which is that kind of present moment awareness, this presence. There's also samajanya, which is that kind of continuity of awareness over time.
Mm.
There is a kind of, sometimes there's a bit of a balance between those. I think both of those are a part of mindfulness.
Could be, yeah. Although I took the point that deliberately comparing is a thought activity. So in talking about conditionality, we are looking at theory, the Buddha's theory about how things are, which does involve us abstracting a bit, looking at the bigger picture, the general picture. So basically this theory consists of the idea that everything is arising on conditions and ceasing when those conditions cease. Now, although this might sound unobjectionable, fairly straightforward, actually, straight away, it reveals itself as different from two other points of view on the nature of reality. Firstly, it means there isn't a God. If by God we mean a creator God who stands outside of things and is unchanging. If everything is arising on conditions and ceases when those conditions cease, then in this universe of things arising on conditions, there can't be an unchanging creator who's responsible for things. So in terms of the Buddhist view of life, it's a neat way to say why there isn't a God. On the other hand, it's also a neat way to say that things don't arise randomly. We don't live in the midst of chaos. Things are arising on particular conditions, particular causes and conditions. In this sense, conditionality is a middle way. This is a very important way of thinking about the Buddhist teaching, as a middle way. In this case, between determinism, the idea that everything is fixed, for instance, by a creator God, and chaos, things being random.
Aren't you also saying, that in a way, that there's no beginning, and possibly that there's no end?
That's a very nice point, actually. Yes, the way the Buddha develops his own idea about the nature of reality is that, yes, you can't perceive a beginning to samsara, to the nature of things. It's beginningless, because a beginning implies a sudden appearance from nowhere of things. And of course there can't be an end. How these ideas relate to modern science, it gets quite tricky. But I don't think it's impossible to have a conversation, in a way. I don't know if any of you are interested in modern cosmology. But, you know, the Big Bang in modern cosmology is an interesting one, because in a way, it means at a certain point space and time themselves sprung into existence, and you can't say anything about the universe before that time. So it's not quite the same as saying there was a beginning. It just means you can't say anything about what was before. Would that make sense as you understand it?
That would make your Big Bang theory materialistic, wouldn't it?
Sorry, I don't know what you mean.
I suppose for a Buddhist sense there are other things in the world apart from matter.
It's true. I was going to go on to say, actually, maybe I'll just carry on, and this will probably...
In science, there's things other than matter as well.
Yeah. I mean, matter is quite a late development in the universe, isn't it? Well, after a few seconds. In a way, it can sound like conditionality is, the Buddhist teaching is rather similar to science, in that the scientific endeavour has been all about trying to discover natural laws which describe how the world works. And it's been extremely successful, of course. In a way, I think the Buddhist teaching is particularly makes a lot of sense to us modern Westerners, I think, because it has a lot in common with the scientific worldview of everything working according to natural laws. But on the other hand, the Buddha was quite happy with the supernatural as well. I don't know if that fits with what you were implying. I was thinking about this a bit today. I'm sure the Buddha would have been quite happy with scientific accounts of how the world works. But the early Buddhist scriptures are full of stories of the Buddha encountering various classes of being who are not material, yakas or demons and gods of all sorts of levels of refinement. And these are non-material beings. But the way the Buddha relates to them and talks about them, the way the Buddhist tradition relates to them, is that they too arise on conditions and pass away when those conditions cease. So even though there might be all kinds of beings, gods, happenings, which perhaps aren't explained by science, don't come within the possibility of a materialistic explanation, the way the Buddha relates to them is always within dependent arising.
And not to say that these beings exist or existed exclusively in the realm of consciousness, but wouldn't you say that's the case for consciousness as well? And possibly sort of what the Buddha had in mind when he was talking about...
Say a bit more, I think.
So, you know, you're talking about the laws of nature and how
yeah,
things kind of
yeah.
sort of evolve from conditions, and I think, well, I'm wondering to what extent conditionality was something that he was talking about in the realm of consciousness more than anything else.
Yeah, so actually that point takes me quite nicely to the next step. I've been talking about conditionality in relation to science because it gives us a way to make connections. But not only was the Buddha also interested in applying it to the supernatural, but actually he wasn't a scientist in any sense. The Buddha wasn't, he hardly ever talked about the nature of the universe or made any attempts to explain things outside human experience. In fact, quite often he simply said, "I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha." In fact, he said, "I only teach dukkha and the end of dukkha," which is to say, suffering or unsatisfactoriness, the quality of life being not perfect. That's what the Buddha taught, and he taught the end of that as well, which is to say awakening or nirvana.
But did he believe that there was a universe outside human experience?
It's just that he often, there's a sort of set formula in the early Buddhist texts when the Buddha's approached by various characters who say, "What do you think, Gotama, about these big questions? Is the world infinite or not? Does the world have a beginning or not? Is the life principle the same as the body or different?" And stuff like that. And he always says, he doesn't give an answer to these questions. He doesn't say there it might be like this or not. He just doesn't get involved. And it's one of those interesting questions, exactly what he meant, whether he knew what the answer was but didn't say, or didn't think there was an answer but didn't say. But what he actually said is that it's not relevant. It doesn't conduce to dispassion, to disenchantment, to liberation, to awakening, to investigate those questions. What I teach is just dukkha and the end of dukkha. This is a very common formula. And I think what it means is that it points to how our interest in explaining the nature of things, to know what the truth is in some big metaphysical sense, is as true now as it was in the Buddhist time. Some people are really keen to know, you know, in those days, does the world have a beginning or not? Well, these days it would be something like, is there intelligent life anywhere else in the universe? But what a fantastic question, isn't it? It's really fascinating. Surely there must be, or not? Perhaps we're alone. Or can consciousness exist independent of the brain? Isn't that a big question? Whoa, fantastic question. And these are just the kinds of questions the Buddha would say, would knowing them help you deal with the problem that life isn't a perfect situation? Would your obsession with trying to answer them get you to that? And that's all he's interested in, is teaching why life isn't yet a perfect situation and how to get there. So this is how conditionality is like a way of seeing. It's a way of approaching the process of investigating, as it were, to find the right questions, to find the right way of seeing existence.
How does the dependent arising relate to dukkha?
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the first half of the Buddha's teaching, you could say. The quality of dukkha in our experience, the quality of things being painful or unsatisfactory or simply imperfect in some big sense, has not arisen because of a god or because things arise randomly. It's arisen on conditions. Particular causes and conditions. And these are what the Buddha teach. These conditions are what the Buddha teaches. So in that sense, because dukkha arises on certain causes and conditions, it's possible to change our experience, to bring in new conditions which alter the pattern of our experience and leads ultimately to the end of dukkha. That's kind of obvious, isn't it? I don't know. I've given you just the schema there.
It's one of the principal conditions that the Buddha identifies as being the source of dukkha is craving.
Yeah. I was going to get onto that. Yeah. Maybe I should say that straight away then and change the order of my talk around spontaneously. Yes. Brilliant. Yes.
Spontaneously, but not randomly.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Spontaneity is good, but it throws me a bit. First of all, we'll go via an implication of conditionality. I think this is the way I'll present it. So, if everything arises on conditions and ceases when those conditions cease, which is a principle, there's an implication of this straight away for all conditioned phenomena, which is, can you guess? Anybody like to venture a guess?
So what's the question?
Yeah. Oh, you can somebody said change. I said what is the implication of everything, all conditioned things arising on certain conditions and ceasing when those conditions cease? Choice. Or but the implication I was getting at was that everything changes. In a way, nothing can stay the same if... Well, that doesn't quite follow. If things are arising on conditions, it means nothing can be permanent in the sense that unless its conditions are permanent. And in practice, that doesn't really happen.
It can do.
It can do.
And if you don't become enlightened,
yeah.
If you don't move to the dukkha, then it can. That's what it's about, isn't it? Because it's constant. Otherwise, constant. You know, you're making the same mistakes and
right.
Staying in the same.
Yeah, but what's being constant there is the kinds of the quality of experience, as it were. But the experience itself is continually changing. You might say. there's one's continually having new kinds of thoughts.
Yeah, but it's a cycle.
States.
Stays constant.
Right.
But it's all just different kinds of sufferings, isn't it?
Yeah.
And different sets of conditions that continue to produce
the same
different kinds of suffering.
The Buddhist outlook on life follows really from this fact of impermanence. That's all change. That's where I'm going with this. If things are impermanent and constantly changing in our experience, which is something you can check out for yourself in the kind of way I was doing in meditation, you can ask, is anything the same? Does anything stay the same in my experience? And what do we mean? The implication is that let's go back another step. We human beings, I think as organisms, actually, we're the kind of beings, we're the kind of organisms who want to enjoy pleasure. We want to have a nice time. We don't want to suffer. That might be even better way to put it. So the urge to avoid pain and enjoy pleasure is very much a deeply ingrained part of the kind of beings we are. Now, when you put that together with the fact of impermanence, you've got a situation where we're continually seeking to avoid pain and get some pleasure in a situation which is constantly changing, which means that our attempt to gain pleasure can never quite achieve it in the sense that those things that are pleasurable soon pass away again, and those things that are painful can never be completely excluded unless we can somehow magically remove all the conditions that lead to pain. I mean, people try. So we're now getting into the Buddha's analysis of human psychology, really. And he pinpointed the origin of suffering in craving, which is what Vilasamani mentioned. I mean, in a way, this is a kind of just a basic principle. You shouldn't accept it just on face value, I think. You have to check out exactly what this means. But what we mean by craving here is in Pali, tanha, which means literally thirst. It's a metaphor. It's a word which stands for the desire to have a satisfying experience, the desire to move away from dukkha, the desire to permanently sort out our lives so that we can not suffer. And the Buddha simply pointed out that that's the origin of dukkha. Now, this is a very difficult teaching in a way, because for most of us, we experience our desire rather in the other way round. You know, we tend to think that suffering is the origin of desire. You know, what we desire because life isn't so good in a way, and we're seeking to move away from suffering and gain satisfaction. And to some extent, we do manage it. You know, from time to time, some of us are really good at it. In fact, some of us less so. You know, and some of us don't enjoy good bodily health and so on. So the Buddha's offering a rather lateral look at this. He's inviting us to see how the very experience of dukkha or suffering has a condition in our continued attempt to try and avoid it. So it means having to sort of step back from our normal approach to life and ask, well, what is this suffering? What is this imperfection in life? And what maintains it? And the Buddha's rather surprising answer is the very quality of trying to avoid it is a lot to do with why we don't manage it, or why we don't manage to sort it out. So that's the basic connection back to dukkha with conditionality.
Right, thanks. So surely then the real cause of suffering is delusion.
You could think of craving, this word craving, as encompassing different kind of qualities, really. Desire is one, hate is another, and delusion is like the intellectual bit of it. If we weren't deluded, perhaps we'd not be so fooled. But on the other hand, we're not just intellectual creatures, we're driven by our passions. So the quality of craving and desire is probably as much of a problem for us. That seems to be the Buddha's general psychology, anyway.
You've written a book about seeing things clearly.
Yeah.
You haven't written a book about craving.
I suppose I've written... I suppose you can approach the Buddhist path in different ways. And one way would be to very much work on the emotional aspect of your being, your passions. And this is what the Metta Bhavana is doing, largely. It's transforming aversion and negative states into positivity, friendliness. And that's important. And another part of the Buddhist path is trying to clarify one's thinking as much as possible. For instance, by studying the Dharma, generating right view, or by doing meditations such as the mindfulness of breathing, which can lead to a certain kind of stillness and an increase in clarity of thought. And I suppose you could say my book is focusing on the right view, clarity of thought side. But that's an important part of the path, but I wouldn't say it's the whole path. But it's one.
Testing you out, sorry.
So, did I pass? Did I pass? Did I pass? Thank you. Going back to the craving, you know, I want to bring in an idea from Sangharakshita, the founder of our Tri Ratna Buddhist movement. He's come up with what I think is a really useful distinction between two kinds of mental functioning. I suspect some of you will have be quite familiar with this, the idea that the mind can work in a reactive mode or a creative mode. Reactive or creative. Funnily, he got this from a crackpot science fiction writer called L. Ron Hubbard, yeah, founder of Scientology, I believe. It's not a Buddhist teaching, the idea of a reactive mind. But actually, I think maybe Sangharakshita's come up with the idea of creative mind. So, and the way he introduced this distinction is a really useful way, I think, in my opinion, of understanding the Buddha's psychology. When the Buddha was describing craving, tanha, as the origin of dukkha, what he was pointing to was the way in our experience we seek to avoid pain and get pleasant experience is in the mode of reacting to stimuli. So you feel something painful, you immediately seek to end it, move away from it, avert from it. You find some form of gratification or pleasure and you immediately move towards it. You don't need to think, as it were. In fact, we often don't think too much, or we think afterwards to try and, you know, justify, work out, improve our chances of doing the same thing. The reactive tendency of mind really, again, belongs to our organism, I think. It's not anything necessarily karmic, to use that kind of expression, in my opinion. Other people are sure to disagree with that, I'm sure. But I think the Buddha was getting at what this human experience is like. often the suffering in our experience arises because we're entrenched in certain habits of reaction to what's gone on. I mean, these are often very understandable. They go back to childhood, they go back to all sorts of patterns. And yet, that's where the problems start from. And this is what the teaching of Tanha is getting at. Not so much the quality of craving, but the quality of reaction that goes on in our experience. So far, so miserable, huh?
It seems that this reduction of the human organism to pleasure and pain,
yeah,
is sort of a bit simplistic.
Yeah.
But humans are a lot more complicated than that, aren't they? So I just find that reducing it to that pleasure and pain principle is a bit... I don't see the point in that, really.
Because it's too simplistic, do you think?
I just think human beings are far more complicated than this mechanism that's of going towards pleasure and avoiding pain. I think human beings aren't that simple.
No.
So what else is
there? Well, but much of our behaviour fits into the... Sorry, I'll say that again. Much of my behaviour fits into that anyway. I mean, I tend to pursue the things which interest me.
It's reducing that all...
Really, the creative part is
when
you're not doing that. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a creative part, but don't do that. It's like you're picking something out of the reaction. You realise you've had the reaction, and instead of worrying and denying, you try and make something out of, yes, you've had that reaction, and you realise maybe a bit of denial going on, but then that's the act of creativity and actually realising.
Yeah.
Actually being able to move towards doing something about it while probably still doing some of the behaviour.
Yeah.
It's creativity there and reactivity at the same time.
Yeah. I wouldn't deny that what I just sketched was a rather simplistic psychology, perhaps. I think that's what I'm just sitting with, just wondering, is it a bit simplistic? But perhaps the thing is we can't... what's simplistic is just presenting the reactive mind as the whole picture. Perhaps from the beginning we need to talk about how the mind is also and always creative. Maybe that's what we need to talk about straight away. So in Sangharakshita's account of two kinds of mental functioning, there's this reactive tendency of the mind. There's also a creative tendency of the mind.
So how does...
Which is, as it were, defined or can be described by, in terms of, the presence of awareness, which introduces a bit of spaciousness into experience.
So how does that fit into, conditioned arising?
Yeah.
So... If everything arises out of certain conditions, right?
Yeah.
Then how does creativity, which by nature is sort of independent or a break with what's happened before, right?
Yeah.
How
does
that arise in a conditioned environment? Right?
Yeah. So it can look like, if we talk about dependent arising in a really thoroughgoing way, it looks like we're in a determined universe, yeah, where things arise on conditions. And there's no way for us to particularly change those conditions or escape from our human condition. Again, the Buddha's middle way is, the way he puts it, is that his teaching is a middle way between everything being determined, in the Buddhist language, by karma, and us living in a completely indeterminate sort of universe where on the other side is that, you know, we can try and change things, but it doesn't matter because everything, nothing has causes. What's in the middle is that the human capacity to be aware, to be mindful, introduces, as it were, choice. I think we know this at a certain level, if you see what I mean. And the idea of everything being determined and fixed is like an idea, as it were. It's like it can be like a fixed view we might have. But if we look into our experience, we notice all sorts of choices being made that can come from awareness. Were you going to say something?
I was just wondering, I hear you asking, what are the conditions which give rise to the creative mind? I suppose what I was going to say is that I guess a part of our nature, so our conditioned nature, is what I would call spiritual. So there is a kind of there's an aspect to us which knows our nature already and has that expansive, open quality to it, which I would suggest is the basis for our.
Yeah, no, and you know, in practical terms, I know it's there, and sort of seek it, but I think in terms of philosophical terms, or you know, I'm just trying to understand the sort of the logic of it. If you have this kind of conditioned arising, or maybe not getting the terms right, but you know, how does that coexist with choice and sort of creativity?
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, to me, it's about, you know, there is choice, there is the ability to act differently, but it's at certain sort of pivot points, and it's kind of at the margin, if you will. And so, you know, it's sort of recognizing those moments or those situations where there is sort of a fork in the road, if you will, and sort of consciously making a choice to go one way or the other. Does that make sense?
That's at every moment, though, every single moment.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's, you know, once every blue moon. I'm saying that not at every single moment you have a choice about everything in the universe, right? You know, we can sit here today and will for, you know, for war to end, and it's not going to happen, right? But, you know, it's the sort of the accumulation of decisions and choices over time, you know, over many different conscious beings that leads to outcomes.
Yeah, right? Yeah. When we start to think like this, we notice that that this simple principle of conditionality, when we try to understand how it works in experience, just raises a lot of questions. For instance, where is the freedom? Where are the moments of choice? Where can we be aware in such a way that it makes a difference in our lives, as it were? And I mention that by way of saying there's the answer isn't so much. The Buddha doesn't have like definite answers to these questions, but like invites us to investigate in a way. My personal feeling is that the teaching of awareness in the Buddhist tradition does open up the possibility of increasing choice, increasing creative states, which at the same time, the broader sense of Buddhist doctrine, based on the ideas of karma, which we haven't got any time to talk about tonight, mean that in some ways we're always reaping the consequences of what's happened in the past, what we've chosen to do, as it were, in ways that are very hard to avoid, if that makes sense. And yet the quality of awareness can change how we respond in the moment. There's always that possibility of changing how we respond in the moment. So you see the kind of constant, it's not so much battle, but struggle to make sense of what's happening.
It's connections.
The connections.
In a way, the cover problem of whether they're acute, the motive, right?
There's a what, sorry?
Whether there's a chooser to make the choice.
Right. We can talk about choice, but then
that raises
the question, well, what I do is making the choice.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The more you go into this, the more complicated it gets. There's a lovely sutta, though, that Sagramati, who's a very brainy order member, put me onto, where the Buddha describes to some an interlocutor, somebody who's having an argument with, who says that we never have any choice. We're always determined in our next moment. And the Buddha points out, well, isn't there a power of initiating action? Don't we have this kind of power of initiating new actions? And the way the Buddha put things is usually very subtle. So he wants to talk about choice, but in such a way that it's quite evident you don't need to talk about a chooser. So if there's a power of initiating actions, all that there needs to be then is a quality of intelligence at work which can initiate positive, skillful events. And that will have repercussions later on. And yet there's a quality of freedom in that initiating, which means our experience can change. I'm just mentioning that by way of getting into the way the Buddha addressed these mysterious questions. So I better head towards wrapping this up, starting from the idea of the creative mind being that mental tendency, the tendency of mind, which begins from our power of awareness. The Buddhist path can proceed, as it were. So the Buddhist path also arises on conditions. It arises on mainly the condition of awareness. But there are a couple of other ways in which the Buddhist path is described in the Pali Canon in different ways. There's a famous account of it which starts from faith. The factors of the path, the so-called spiral path, as we talk about it in the Triratna tradition, starts from faith. On condition of unsatisfactoriness, of dukkha, can arise faith, which is to say, if you recognise it and what's going on, a certain faith in the Buddha's teaching can arise, a confidence that there is that the Buddha's teaching offers a way forward. But there's other accounts of the spiral path which start from awareness, and another one which starts from the practice of ethics, which is to say, if we notice how our lives, how we act in our lives can be, we've got a choice, then choosing to act in an ethical way, which is to say to keep the precepts, to cultivate the positive, to look to the well-being of other people as well as ourselves, that can also be a condition for the path, for the arising of the path. So I mention that so that it's clear that it's not simply awareness that can start us off on the Buddhist path, but also the practice of ethics and faith in the Buddha's teaching, which can cause us, as it were, to make changes in our lives. So I've sketched out some ideas, really, from the Buddha's teaching on conditionality. Overall, the more we study conditionality, the more we study Paticca-samuppada, the more, as it were, we start to appreciate conditionality as a way of seeing the nature of things. And in that sense, from right view, from taking it on as a good, an interesting set of ideas, a set of ideas that we think might be of interest, it becomes increasingly a matter of understanding how the world appears to an awakened being. In that sense, right view can become what Sangharakshita calls perfect vision.